All right, a couple of announcements before we begin. We will make the formal announcements on Wednesday and Thursday, but the annual business meeting will be next Sunday. In second session, we probably will cut short and maybe start at about 11:30 so that we're sure we have enough time to deal with the things we have to deal with. And, of course, all meetings are open to members, so this would include our regularly scheduled board meetings. We call that the Deacons Meeting only because it's just been named that. And or corporate board meetings are open to members. So if you want to be notified as to when these are ahead of time, just contact Rich and we'll figure out a system to do that. All right, let's make sure you're in fellowship and continue on here dealing with this matter of this man. Another man who lives a long life, prosperous at some levels, sexually prosperous certainly, if he fathers 100 children, and lives many years, but he isn't satisfied with all this, then Solomon says there's a better way to live. In fact, not living at all is better than that. So if a man fathers 100 children, and lives many years, however many they may be. But his soul is not satisfied with his prosperity. And again, I just use that as a singular term for the good. But it would include all the good things in life as a kind of a singular to deal with all the various aspects of good. And he does not even have a proper burial. And again, I take this as not that he's not buried, but that he's not given what one would customarily expect. At a burial. Then I say, better the miscarriage than he. And again, the Cal Perfect here may be translated, then I said, pointing back to an earlier time in Solomon's life when he looked at this. And again, Solomon is looking at life as it's visible out here, under the sun, the things you can see. And Solomon, I believe, to be truly orthodox, completely orthodox. I believe that he's not teaching false doctrine. But he is certainly contrasting what we know by faith and how we have to walk by faith with what we see out here in the world by sight. And those are in sometimes great contradiction to one another. And that poses a problem, puts pressure on the believer's soul as to why these things are so. And again, behind all of this, I'm convinced certainly, is the reality of the fall that Solomon was keenly aware that this isn't God's best work, per se. Because the fall has dramatically affected things. And actually, while I was in Oklahoma, somebody showed me some book they were reading. It was this guy. Essentially, it was God Doesn't Do Good Work was kind of the title of it or something. So I don't think it was, doctrinal. So I didn't read it, but... I said, whether or not this was past, that becomes an issue here, and you have to watch the tense of the verbs. As a matter of fact, this is one of the dangers, and I saw this very much throughout this passage here, is that you cannot let your initial translation, the New American Standard from which we work, too much affect. You've got to be looking at the language. So again, this is, if he was talking in the present tense, I would more expect this to be an imperfect. I will say, or I am saying, rather than I said. Better the miscarriage than he. And sometimes, as we look at the world out here, even with all the doctrine we have, we might articulate similar sentiments. We might look at it and say, he's better off just not having certain things or doing certain things. For it comes in futility and goes into obscurity. And its name is covered in obscurity. It never sees the sun and it never knows anything. It is better off than he. And even if a man lives 1,000 years twice and does not enjoy what is good, do not all go to the same place? And so we were looking at here in Jewish culture dealing with this issue of a proper burial. And I think the New American Standard here has rightly supplied that. Not that he doesn't have a burial at all, but it's not the customary burial one would expect. 2 Kings 9:30 is the one we're ready to look at now, 30 through 37. This is the one we had just been introduced to, is Jezebel. You know, certain things happen in life. You know, Jezebel's not a popular name anymore. Nobody names their daughter Jezebel. Nobody names their son Judas. Why? Because these names have such a stigma attached to them because of their evil that people don't want anything to do with them. So here you got Jezebel here. When Jehu came to Jezreel, Jezebel heard of it. And she painted her eyes and adorned her head and looked out the window. And as Jehu entered the gate, he said, "Is it well, Zimri, your master's murderer?" And then he lifted his face up to the window and said, "Who is on my side? Who?" And two or three officials looked down at him. And he said, "Throw her down." So they threw her down, and some of her blood was sprinkled on the wall and on the horses, and he trampled her underfoot. And when he came in, he ate and drank and said, "See now to this cursed woman and bury her, for she is a king's daughter." See, even under normal circumstances, because she was descended from royalty, there was going to be what would be considered at least a customary burial for her. They went to bury her, but they found nothing more than the skull and the feet and the palms of her hands. Therefore, they returned and told him, and he said, "This is the word of the Lord, which he spoke by his servant Elijah the Tishbite, saying, in the property of Jezreel, the dog shall eat the flesh of Jezebel, and the corpse of Jezebel shall be as dung on the face of the field in the property of Jezreel." So they cannot say, this is Jezebel. She's not going to have even a, you know, a marked grave there because of her evil. Isaiah 14:9, in what is very possibly a dual prophecy. These dual prophecies get to be very difficult in that one has to be careful as to what they apply to the human aspect of it and the unseen spiritual aspect behind it. In this case, it would appear, as it's addressed to here, the king of Babylon, this taunt in verse 4, is addressed to the king of Babylon. How the oppressor has ceased, and how the fury has ceased. Here in verse 19, as it gets down, this appears to be a prophecy, a dual prophecy, that refers both to the ruler of Babylon, who is going to be cast down in Daniel's 70th week, and to Satan himself. But very often, I mean, this is not unusual. You see it also in Ezekiel, where he writes to the prince of Tyre, and then he writes to the king of Tyre. And the prince appears to be the earthly ruler, whereas the king appears to be the ruler behind the scenes, i.e. Satan, or Lucifer, as his pre-fall name was known. Isaiah 14:19, "But you have been cast out of your tomb like a rejected branch, clothed with the slain who are pierced with a sword, who go down to the stones of the pit like a trampled corpse. You will not be united with them in burial because you have ruined your country. You have slain your people. May the offspring of evildoers not be mentioned forever." And so this is another reason why for evildoers you wouldn't have, quote, a proper burial. You don't even want a marker. You don't want a remembrance of these people. God wants to blot out the memory of them from the planet. This part of the prophecy appears, I mean, to me, to refer to the king himself. Here all the kings of the nations, verse 18, lie in glory, each in his tomb, but you don't get a proper burial. And as we know, as we understand from the prophecy, when the nuclear warheads start falling, they're not going to be worried too much about burying people. And it would appear that the king of Babylon, our president, will not escape, certainly. No matter how the plans are for him to escape, he won't. Or, shall I say, maybe her. Who knows? Jeremiah 22:19 also. If politics is nothing else, at least it gives you something to watch. I mean, I'd rather watch these idiots out there doing their thing than American Idol. So it's at least, you know, a little more intelligent. And occasionally they'll actually have, you know, some good interchanges, but not all that often. But it does provide fodder for like the Daily Show and stuff like that, which is, you know, worth, I think, is humorous. Jeremiah 22:19, he will be buried with a donkey's burial. Dragged off here in regard to Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah. Verse 18, they will not lament him. For him, alas, my brother, or alas, sister. They will not lament for him, alas, for the master, alas, for his splendor. He will be buried with a donkey's burial. Dragged off and thrown beyond the gates of Jerusalem. Again, the ultimate insult here at the end of life. And 36:30. Therefore, says the Lord concerning Jehoiakim, king of Judah, he will have no one to sit on the throne of David, and his dead body will be cast out to the heat of the day and the frost of the night. And again, not a proper burial because of his evil. And the last one here in the New Testament, let's see, Revelation 11:19. And here in this context, of course, we're looking at the insult to the two primary players in the first half of Daniel's 70th week from a doctrinal standpoint. You have several major players, I believe. You have these two characters, these resuscitated believers, whom I believe from the study, Moses and Elijah are the very best candidates that will be brought back to the planet, resuscitated from death, and be able to prove who they are. And they will be playing a major role, but they appear, from what I could tell in the study of all this, that to have their ministry somewhat limited to the land of Israel. They appear to be somewhat sedentary in that they stay in that particular region. Whereas the 144,000, another group of major players in this drama that unfolds following the rapture, appear to be have a worldwide type ministry. They don't appear to be limited to a particular nation. They appear to be, we might call them super evangelists, who are saved, either before or just, well, it have to be just after the rapture, who come to salvation. And who knows what effect the rapture will have on certain people. This whole, the whole Fundy idea used to be, and I remember them pounding us with this one, that, and they did it in this Left Behind series by Hal Lindsey, another great teacher of doctrine. The threat was, if you don't get saved before the rapture, you can't get saved. And this was, they beat people to death with this. And, any study of Revelation indicates that's not true. But they continue to beat people to death with this as a form of, you better get saved now. Don't put it off because the rapture may come. Well, granted, being saved in Daniel's 70th week is going to be far more difficult. You're going to encounter much more difficulty just in terms of life and being able to live in Daniel's 70th week, at least after the middle part of it, after about that first 3 years. The first 3 years appear to be somewhat quiet from a judgment standpoint. But as you approach the day of the Lord proper, that begins at the middle point of Daniel's 70th week, the judgments increase and quickly, and I mean escalate in intensity and frequency. And factor, again, the judgments of God in with the stupidity of man as they set off these nuclear explosions and what it's going to do to the planet. And you're set up for a very serious situation, and one that becomes dire pretty quickly. And so the judgments keep on piling up and piling up, and then you have this sort of ongoing problems that man has created for himself. All of that happens. Well, these two witnesses during that first 3.5 years testify, again, my understanding at this point, is predominantly in the land of Israel. And they pronounce various judgments on various people. And God grants this authority in verse 3 to these two witnesses, and they will prophesy for 1260 days clothed in sackcloth, which extends from what you have at the rapture. You have the church taken out. We immediately end the parenthesis, this dispensation, or that's called the church age, ends. And you're immediately back in the age of Israel. So several things change. Number one, the Holy Spirit no longer indwells believers. That changed. That was something for the church age. And you have several things that go on here. And then you have the final 7 years. This is out of Daniel chapter 9. 24 through 27, I believe. You have the 7 years of human history that has to come to pass. And seven, we call them prophetic years because they're comprised of 360-day years. That appears to be the calendar on which God works. So why could you never set a date for the rapture? Well, very simply, we work on a 365-day calendar. We don't know how many years have actually elapsed. So this would make setting a date, even if you, but you don't have a fixed deal, but even if you knew the church age is about 2,000 years long, even if it was exactly 2,000 years long, you really couldn't fix a date very well for it. The whole point, no man knows the hour or the day kind of thing. That there's a certain ignorance that we're all going to have to live with. So you go back into the age of Israel, well, immediately Antichrist is resuscitated. And Antichrist shows up on the scene. In my opinion, Alexander is still the best candidate for this. And he'll be able to prove who he is. No doubt, he'll be able to actually take them to his burial place, which is still hidden from human history, strangely enough. We have Philip's. We don't have his. And he shows up, then the two witnesses show up. You got three people now resuscitated from the dead who are at complete odds with one another. And, of course, Antichrist will set about doing his deal, I assume, beginning to get his kingdom together and to organize things. And that's going to take him a little while. He doesn't get fully exalted by the world until about the middle, until about 3.5 years, roughly. Then he has achieved sufficient power and sufficient success to be able to command the world at large, or what's left of it. And essentially, I believe the Western Hemisphere will be gone. So you'll have Europe, you'll have the major players that are set forth in the prophecies. You're going to have the EU, that 10-nation confederacy, which he will head up at some point. And we know even in the prophecy there that for whatever reason, and we're not told why, three of the nations he takes out. Maybe they withstand him. Maybe they oppose him. They don't like his brutality, something. We don't know what it is. But we are told that he'll pluck out three of those horns in Daniel there. And so you have the major players. They're going to be the EU. You're going to have a Far Eastern Confederacy, no doubt headed up by the Chinese Communists. As seen in the leopard in Daniel chapter 7 there. You're going to have the Russian bear, who's going to be a big player in all of this. And then you're going to have these other minor players. I mean, let's just face it, while we recognize these nations are legitimate nations and they exist, Egypt is not a world power anymore. But it still exists as a player. Syria is not a world power. Iraq, Iran, these are not world powers. Afghanistan, India. These powers will still be there, as it were, but they occupy, in some ways, a back seat in all of this. The major players are set forth there in Daniel 7. And the lion with the eagle's wings, Great Britain is going to be a factor in this, apparently. We don't know exactly what part they're going to play. As I understand the prophecy, Great Britain is headed for some sort of spiritual renewal, that they're going to come to their senses in all of this. Because the lion is made to stand upright on two legs, which is viewed as a positive thing, I would believe, that an animal and a human mind is given to it. That's a step up in my estimation. So you have all these major players. Well, you got these, and then you got the 144,000 who would appear to be sealed pretty rapidly after this. And they're all over the planet advocating, that the end of the age is upon us. And again, the irony is, if you study any of the current modern stuff, people are aware this is coming. They just don't believe it the way the Bible says it. They have a sense that something's really wrong, that mankind is headed towards catastrophe and disaster, that this age is ending. And they kind of know that. Just as it was pretty common thought among the Jews of the first Advent period that the Messiah was coming. Now, they didn't understand what all that meant, but there was this great messianic expectation that existed during that time. Confused expectation, but expectation nonetheless. And so people would rise up and take advantage of this. I'm the new, I'm the Messiah, blah, blah, blah. And that's where Gamaliel counseled the Jews, hey, this has happened before. Relax. If this Jesus, if this isn't anything, it'll come to nothing. These other guys came to nothing. And so these guys are going to be saying, hey, the end of the age is upon us. The God of heaven is angry, and he's fixing to lower the boom. And the judgments are coming. And the two witnesses not only announce the same thing, they have the power and ability here in chapter 11 here. They're going to prophesy for 1,260 days, which encompasses the first half of Daniel's 70th week. It's comprised of two equal 1,260-day parts. And if anyone wants to harm them, verse 5, fire flows out of their mouth and devours their enemies. And I don't take this as literal. I mean, I don't think they're fire-breathing prophets. But that a figure of speech here for their ability to destroy their enemies. Because it says, it doesn't say they're going to be destroyed by fire. It says, and if anyone wants to harm them, he must be killed in the same way, i.e. the way in which they want to harm them. Whether they do it with a gun, you know, will these prophets have submachine guns to protect themselves? I don't know. Whether they want to try to do it, you know, however they want to try to kill them, poisoning, you know, and it doesn't say they kill him. It just says he must be killed in the same way. The be killed is passive. It doesn't indicate who the agent is. So maybe God intervenes and kills them in the same way. They decide they want to poison him. God poisons them. So these have the power to shut up the sky so that rain will not fall during the days of their prophesying. And they have power over the waters to turn them into blood and to strike the earth with every plague as often as they desire. And the implication being that they do use this power, that they do engage under this, and they flat out tell them. Well, here you got all this going on, and these guys here, well, the world doesn't like these guys, as you might imagine. Negative volition is not very keen on all this. So here we finally see, when they finish their testimony, verse 7, the beast that comes out of the abyss will make war with them. That's a reference to Antichrist. And nobody's able to harm them for that 1,260 days. But once that 1,260 days is up, they're no longer immune under God. And he will overcome them and kill them. And their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which mystically is called Sodom and Egypt. Why apply these names to Jerusalem? Well, I don't want to review all this, but look in the notes and I explain why. That these two names, and it betrays their spiritual condition. These are insults to Jerusalem to be called this, where also their Lord was crucified. So we know clearly. And then the interpreters. Well, he was crucified outside the gates. Okay, it was still Jerusalem. He wasn't crucified in Syria, or Arabia, or any of these other places. So this is an insult, and those peoples will look at their dead bodies for 3.5 days. And they will not permit their dead bodies to be laid in a tomb. And again, how can all the people and tribes look on this? Well, with the advent of television, we know how it's done now. This couldn't have happened 100 years ago. They couldn't have, this verse couldn't have been fulfilled. Many of these things in here couldn't have been fulfilled 100 years ago. Some of them not even 50 years ago. So they don't permit them to be laid in the tomb. This is a form of insult. This is the ultimate insult to them. To not allow them to be buried. And those who dwell on the earth will rejoice over them and celebrate, and they will send gifts to one another. Christmas in February, or whenever it happens. Christmas in August, because these two prophets tormented those who dwell on the earth. So again, the idea that they torment them suggests to me that they will use their power to smite the earth with these various plagues. And not only that, they're probably going to announce what they're doing and then do it, so that everybody knows. This isn't just some Mother Nature went bad, you know, kind of deal. We're going to judge the earth with this. It is not going to rain here for a year. You're not going to get a drop of rain. And then when it doesn't rain, they'll have to admit, well, those guys said they were going to do it, and apparently they did it. So here again, you get sort of the ultimate insult, and it's still, and not even in Jewish culture, but again, even as late as Daniel's 70th week. Failure to be buried is looked at the greatest humiliation you could inflict on somebody. So 23, it would be out of the ordinary, that's not spelled quite right, for a man with plenty of prosperity, a lengthy life, and a great number of children not to be given a proper burial. Therefore, 24, the man that has it all from the human perspective does not receive any real satisfaction from those things that are normally considered blessings and dies unhonored and unlamented. As an example of the extreme frustration and futility that can come in life. And again, this is viewed as, again, the icing on the cake, the final insult, we may say. Not only did he have these things and didn't enjoy them, now the final insult is he's not even going to get what normal people would consider the last thing in life, the last play. 25, he now engages in another bit of hyperbole as he compares the fate of such a person with the fate of the stillborn. Koheleth uses another of his better-than sayings to make his point. 26, the Hebrew term nephil, miscarriage, is derived from the verb to fall. That's not fail in the Hebrew. And denotes that the fetus that does not make it to the actual birth. It might encompass the idea of abortion, although the only three usages here in the Bible would not tend to support that. But definitely refers to a miscarriage. Of the three usages we have, that's easy to document. It's easy to document that they're talking about a miscarriage. And the miscarriage is called, through, and interestingly enough, I mean, clearly this is an interpretative choice. Because you have the cal perfects through here, but they're all third masculine singulars in the verbs. So they could easily translate this, he comes in futility and he goes into obscurity and his name is covered in obscurity. But they've made an interpretative translation here and they've recognized that the fetus is not considered a person. Contrary, again, to Fundy dogma that life begins at conception. It does not. Life, the soul is not imputed until the point of physical birth. And Solomon says, better to die and not even ever live. And that's his whole argument here. The fetus never lives. It only has the physical life that it can gain from the mother. But it's not a viable person. It's not a person at all. Again, to have a soul and to have these things imputed, you've got to have a place to put them. And a single-celled organism doesn't have a place to tie in a soul. I mean, this has to come in a higher brainstem of some kind. So this would require a great deal of development at the bare minimum. And again, we see Adam as an example of this, lying on the ground, fully formed, perfectly human in every way, except he's not alive. And he doesn't live until God breathes into his nostrils the breath of life. And the breath of life appears to be just exactly that, the breath that gives life. And God can give it or take it. So again, this it definitely emphasizes here a miscarriage, which is not viewed as a viable birth. 27, his strong assertion is followed in verse 4 by the conjunction ki, which is designed to introduce his explanation for his opinion. 28, some have attempted to apply this verse to the miserable man of verse 3, based on the fact that the stillborn does not have a name that can be covered or shrouded. And again, darkness is the actual word here. It's in darkness. 29, however, the subject can only be the stillborn, since what follows immediately in verse 6 cannot possibly refer to one among the living. It never sees the sun. Again, is this the guy? And actually, that should have been in verse 5, I'm sorry. What follows in verse 5? Living people see the sun. I mean, unless they're born blind, I suppose. But the idea here is that they experience life. His whole argument here is that the stillborn doesn't. The stillborn never has life. It's not viewed, again, as a viable person. 30, Koheleth makes three assertions about the miscarriage. A, it comes in vanity, which is likely designed to communicate the dual ideas inherent in the term hevel, of futility, meaninglessness, and transience. The stillborn's existence, as it were, is very transient, far more transient even than our lives, but goes by very quickly, clearly. I think the major emphasis in here would be on the idea of futility. It's a waste of time. It's vain. It doesn't amount to anything. It's empty. B, it goes into darkness, which indicates that the fetus has no vision or knowledge of the world. And C, its name is covered in darkness, indicates that the miscarriage likely did not receive a name, which would be the norm. People, while people may pick out a name for a child before it's born, that was not the biblical way it was done, typically. The children were named at birth. And and they could be named for a number of reasons. Maybe some physical characteristic they had. Why was Esau named Esau? Well, the word Esau means red. Esau was a red guy. He had a red complexion, probably a redhead, most likely. And why was Jacob named Jacob? What does Jacob mean? Jacob means the supplanter, one who grabs by the heel, because when he was born, he came out holding on to Esau's heel. Esau was the firstborn, but in a prophetic sense, Jacob was going to supplant him, in a spiritual sense. And he did. And God would have done all this, by the way, and you study the life of Jacob. God would have done all this anyway without, you know, Rachel's manipulation, without, rather, Rebecca's manipulation, without Jacob's manipulation. God didn't need all their help. He was able to do it all on his own. But again, and sometimes the child was born because of the circumstances, was named rather because of the circumstances. If you look in Jacob's wives, you know, they named their children certain things. You know, one of them was named Gad because Gad means how fortunate. And so the woman viewed this birth as being fortunate. And so, and one of the things that happened was, for instance, in the death of Joseph, or rather the birth of Joseph, Rachel attempted to name him one thing while she was dying, and Jacob overruled her and renamed him. And the father had the final say in all that too, by the way. So again, it could be something that was prophetic, could be some hope they had for the child. And the idea is that your name is significant in life. Your name means something. And you can go get a book. I mean, they have it, or you don't have to get a book, but you look on the internet. You can look up and see what your name means, where it's derived. It has a meaning. And so the miscarriage, it didn't receive a name. Because, again, this is, you can't read our culture back into this and say, well, everybody has a name for babies. Well, they didn't then. And this is the world in which Solomon writes. So 31, he continues in verse 5 with the fact that the stillborn never sees the sun, which augments the emphasis of the previous verse on darkness. By using the conjunction gam, again, indeed, or furthermore, there in verse 5, furthermore, it never sees the sun. 32, he refers to the sun without the definite article, which is unusual in this book, because most of the time, it's the definite article, it's the sun. But this is designed to emphasize the light of the sun, the idea that it doesn't see the light of day, we might say. Would be a good interpretative translation here. It never sees sunlight, not the sun per se. I mean, he could have said the sun if that's what he wanted to do. 24, for Koheleth to see the sun is tantamount to living. Therefore, to have not seen the sun is equivalent to having never lived. Job 3:16, and this, of course, is where Job gets under his STA and cracks. He cracked under this test. And even the strongest believer can crack under a test. Doesn't mean God's done with them. Doesn't mean that, you know, they can't recover. Job here, 3:16, as he says here, or like the miscarriage, which is discarded, I would not be. In other words, I would not exist. The miscarriage didn't exist. As infants that never saw light. And that's what he's praying for. He's saying, you know, why did I even have to die, to live? To die at birth would have been better than this, than to live through this existence. And obviously Job is now focused strictly upon himself and his tests and his pressures that he's facing. He's forgotten at some level the blessings of his life at that point. The testing is so serious and so significant. And that's why James urges believers when he says, consider every joy when you encounter various testing. That's the time you have to challenge yourself to think back. Okay, you can get under your test. You can react to it. You can freak out. You can get under your STA. You can resent it. You can reject it. But still, number one, you're still going to go through it. But then, instead of bemoaning your fate, James says, think about every blessing you've got in life when you face these tests and these trials. Because certain parts of life are good. You do have good parts in your life, right? You know, if you don't, you're the most miserable of all persons. But everybody has good things that happen to them, things in life that they appreciate, and all that. And he said, when you're under testing, that's where you need to focus. Well, Job, again, because of the pressure of all of this and all the things, the physical pain, the mental pain, the spiritual pressure he's under, he cracks and said, why didn't I die at birth, verse 11? Come forth from the womb and expire. It would be better for me to just been born dead. Now, that's a miserable person talking. And if you try to read divine viewpoint into what Job's saying here, you are just blowing the interpretation of the book. Job is not in fellowship. He isn't advocating God's view of these things. He's just saying, I wish I was dead. And normally when you're feeling like that, you're probably not going to come up with a divine viewpoint. I'd rather be dead. And then our chapter 7 also, oh, it's not our verse, I'm sorry. Chapter 7 in Ecclesiastes, verse 11. Wisdom coupled with an inheritance is good. So is wisdom good? Sure. Is wisdom better if you got some money? Solomon says, yeah. Duh. Of course it is. And an advantage to those who see the sun, i.e. those who are alive. You know, it's not an advantage if you're dead. You don't, you know, if you died and then you found out you inherited all this stuff, well, if you're dead, what good is it? It's no good. So to see the sun here is tantamount, again, to never having lived. To not see the sun, rather. To see the sun is tantamount to being alive. 35, he concludes his description of the miscarriage by asserting the fact that the stillborn fetus never knows anything. 36, the fact that the verb yadad, to know, does not have a direct object has troubled some, who then attempt to make the term nakath, rest, ease, or quietness, the object of the verb. And what they try to do is it never knows anything, but the way he set up his sentence structure here, indeed, sunlight it does not see, and it does not know, and they tried to take the feminine singular noun that follows, it does not know rest. But then the following phrase makes no sense to this one or that one, or to this one from that one. That doesn't fit. If you make it the direct object, to me it doesn't fit. So 37, however, it is not the object of the verb to know, it is to be construed with what follows, which forms one more of the better than or more than situations which are used throughout this book. 38, in fact, the verb yada, to know, is used without any object in other passages with the meaning of simply having knowledge or not having knowledge. For instance, Psalm 73:22, one in which yada is used without any object. And you wouldn't pick up on it from the English translation. But he says, I literally, it's a negative, I did not know. And he doesn't say what he did not know. And they've translated this ignorant. I was senseless and did not know. Again, it doesn't say know what. Just says, or I didn't understand even. Would be, you know, you could also do that. Isaiah 44:9 also is another one where it's used without any direct object to just denote, again, having knowledge, or in the case of Psalms there, not having knowledge. Those who fashion a graven image are all of them futile, useless, and their precious things are of no profit. Even their own witnesses fail to see or to know. And there, it's used, you know, in a sense, doesn't say see or know what, but it's the idea of they don't really understand anything, so that they will be put to shame. So again, the argument that this has to always take a direct object, number one, that doesn't fit from the grammar. Number two, we can adduce texts that suggest otherwise. 39, his point is that the untimely birth does not come into this world and experience any of the toil, frustration, and misery that those that live will experience. And I guess one of the questions that you just should beg, you know, I think, certainly makes me stop and wonder, is in spite of all the toil, in spite of all the frustration, in spite of all the testing, and in spite of all the problems you face in life and all of that, isn't your life pretty good? I mean, don't you enjoy it? Aren't there some good things that go with all that? Most people, even in spite of, you know, in their better days and their smarter moments, would say, yeah, I'd rather, you know, they're not anxious to die. You know, even unbelievers out there who may be going through this or that suffering, you know, if it's not just, you know, mind-numbing suffering. You know, they don't want to die over it. They want to stay alive. So, again, this almost argues that some people live through life and they live this life of misery. And they never experience the joy and the contentment and the things in life that I, of course, if they don't have doctrine, they're probably not going to either. Now, they can at a certain level just by orienting to certain principles of divine viewpoint. I mean, they may be content to be a good citizen of the United States. They obey the laws of the land and do all that and do their thing, and they're a good citizen. And so they get a measure of joy and contentment in that. Or if they find right man, right woman, even unbelievers can have this blessing in life, and they get a measure of joy and contentment in that. Will it ultimately satisfy them? You know, probably not. Not forever. So 40, in that regard, Koheleth is pointing out the obvious fact that the stillborn never reaches consciousness, never experiences any of the hardships and misery that characterize the human condition. And this is one of the things. He brutally looks at the human condition and says, you know, there are some very horrible things about it, and we're not going to duck these issues. That life out here under the sun is all these things sometimes. And certainly people have lived this way. So 41, therefore, his final assessment is that the stillborn experiences more rest than the rich man, who had to struggle to get rich and has to struggle to guard and maintain his wealth. And 42, his conclusion is that a life of misery, even though accompanied by various levels of prosperity and various types, again, not just physical prosperity and money in the details, the good would be all of it, sexual prosperity, a long life, and all that. So, again, if it's even when it's accompanied by various levels and types of prosperity, and obviously we know the levels of prosperity differ from one to another, is worse than a miscarriage, which never sees the light and never struggles in the arena of life. 43, Koheleth bolsters his position by introducing a prothesis that contains a hypothetical element that is followed by a rhetorical question. And 44, he has used hyperbole several times in this section and now gets specific about the nature of long life by introducing someone who lives an unrealistically long life. If a man lives 1,000 years twice, does anybody really want to live that long? I mean, you got to figure the body's going to be in a real bad shape by then if you're 2,000 years old. You know, I wouldn't expect that you would have, you know, much left. So 45, if a man could live 2,000 years, more than double the life of Methuselah, those years would still be meaningless if one did not find enjoyment in them. And again, people, and how much they're even aware of this, I don't know, but as I look upon the human condition out there, and as Solomon looked upon it, he saw a lot of people that were miserable people, and that are just treading water in life, we might say. They're not happy, they're not content, they don't enjoy life, they live it, they go through it, but they're just treading water. And some of them, I wonder, you know, we've discussed this, how much they even know how miserable they really are? Or do they just accept, you know, that this is just life, is just this way? This is what life is, this is all I've ever known. So to them, maybe it's not quite as miserable, but from the divine viewpoint, their life is awful. So again, if one doesn't find some enjoyment in them, what's life for? And is it worth living? Well, 46, those excessive years would not only be meaningless. Life itself would become a source of increasing frustration if one was not happy while living it. I mean, if you're a miserable person and you just continue to deteriorate in your misery, a long life isn't a prosperous idea. It isn't a blessing. It would be awful. Well, 47, this gives a different perspective to the traditional wisdom literature that indicated long life was always considered a blessing, a reward for the righteous. Here, point 48, Koheleth acknowledges that a long life without gratification was not always necessarily a good thing. 49, in the end, even if one lived a thoroughly enjoyable life, although that is not his focus here, even that life will eventually come to an end. Even for the person that enjoys life, and that is prospered by God and blessed and has capacity for it, they're still going to die. That life's going to end, as it were. Now, you don't cease to exist. You cease to exist on this physical plane. But the soul, the real you, obviously, resides in a different place. And I think Solomon's completely orthodox. I think he knows, although he poses these hard questions, I fully believe Solomon is orthodox in that he knows people die and that believers go to heaven, as it were, and unbelievers go to hell. And he knows there's a judgment coming by God who's going to make all things right in this life. But his issue is, it's the life right now that I see. And God isn't making all things right. And that's a source of frustration at some level. And so one can question the goodness of God, the justice of God, the judgment of God. One can question all those things. But the fact is, he's still God, and he still has a plan in all this. A superior plan to what we see. So 50, his conclusion is that the lifeless fetus and the man who endured a long but unhappy life are both destined for Sheol. However, the lifeless miscarriage is to be congratulated because it reached the goal more quickly. I beat you there. And with less stress and trauma. Now, again, is that the divine viewpoint of life? Or is Solomon just saying, this is my view on how I see it? It appears to me that the divine viewpoint is that life is a blessing. Not to have life is not considered a blessing. So 51, the one time Solomon uses the term Sheol in this book appears to emphasize the grave itself or the state of death. And that's in chapter 9. This is the only time he uses Sheol. Matter of fact, he doesn't use it here in this passage. When he says to the one place, the idea I think he's driving at is they both go to the grave. Ecclesiastes 9:10, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For there is no activity or planning or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol where you are going. And that is kind of the same sentiment that Jesus expressed when he said, the night is coming when no man can work. And the night he was referring to was physical death. That's what Solomon's saying. Death is coming. It's inevitable. And you're not going to do anything after that. You better make your mark. You better do what you're going to do in the here and now. And this, obviously, is another one of his positive pieces of advice to his younger readers. Do what you do, and do it with all your soul and with all your might. 52, one should not conclude that Solomon lacked understanding of life after death. I don't buy that at all. I think Solomon's orthodox. I think he knows these things. But he doesn't choose to focus on those things. He sort of chooses to leave that out of his arguments. A resurrection, a judgment, or other things associated with the afterlife. And again, people base that sort of assessment on what he says in 3:17. And I said to myself, see, Solomon's orthodox. He knows this. This is the inner man talking. We have Solomon, sometimes the outer Solomon's talking, sometimes the inner Solomon's talking. You talk to yourself, don't you? Don't you wonder sometimes how many people are in there? Sometimes, you know, you can at least account for three. You talk to yourself, you answer yourself, and then you're thinking about what you're saying. So this inner dialogue goes on, and Solomon expresses his inner dialogue. I said to myself, okay, here's what I know from doctrine. God will judge the righteous man and the wicked man, and there's a time for every matter. So he's clear on all this, in his right mind, we might say, in his doctrinal mind. But unfortunately, we have a non-doctrinal mind, a doctrinal mind, and then a mind that even passes judgment on what you're thinking. And so you have to deal with that. Well, 53, he simply focuses on the aspect of death that most naturally suits his purposes in writing. He wants his readers to see the death as the end of all endeavors under the sun. Proverbs 5:5, the death is, as it were, the final curtain, for lack of a better phrase. And the play is over. The play that was life. Here the adulterous woman, her feet go down to death. Her steps take hold of Sheol, i.e. the place of death. And this may just be synonymous parallelism where death and Sheol are viewed as the same thing. Proverbs 7:27 also. Same thing here. Her house is the way to Sheol, descending to the chambers of death. And there was obviously there's a strain of thought in which Sheol is the place of the dead. That's it's death itself. Ecclesiastes 9:10, we saw that one, and Song of Solomon 8:6 is the last one today. And there he says, there's no planning or activity or wisdom or all that in Sheol where you're going. When you die, your day's done. Song of Solomon 8:6, put me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm. For love is as strong as death. Jealousy is as severe as Sheol. And again, whether he's dealing with, you know, it appears to be synonymous parallelism where he's saying the same thing in the second stitch that he says in the first stitch. Okay, well, time is up, so we will stop there and let you ponder whether or not you think life is better than never having been born, as Solomon did. At least at one point in his life, he articulated this viewpoint. Now, again, is this what he ultimately comes to believe? Is this what he would endorse at the end of his life? Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen. Thank you.